You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. With the lifting of the sanctions against Iraq, the UN seems to have legitimized the U.S.-led invasion into that country. Meanwhile, peace activists are regrouping and deciding their next steps. Jack O'Dell, an American who works for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and former chair of the Pacifica Radio National Board, recently stopped by Peace Watch's studios, and he discussed the media coverage of the war in Iraq and his vision for the peace movement.
We're quite pleased with the coverage of news in general because ours is a public broadcast. It's publicly owned. There are some private TV and radio stations, but in Canada, the Canadian Broadcasting System, CBC, is a public corporation. Mm-hmm. And the quality of the news and events and public events and investigative journalism, in my judgment, is very substantial. And on a day-to-day basis, we are able to get a view of events that is probably shared by a majority of the world, but if we were living in a country of my birth, it would be very skewed.
The country of your birth being here in the U.S.
Detroit, Michigan.
How would you characterize the media coverage in Canada around this war? What was the tone, the tenor, what was portrayed, what was left out?
Well, I think the Canadian broadcasting folks reach back and try to find the background to events. The truth of the matter is that the war in Iraq was never over. What we call Gulf War I and then mm-hmm. this one is the same war. It's just another stage of it. So there are two things, I think, in the Canadian presentation. First of all, they try to look at the background and give more information in that regard, that it is not just an event that has just kind of like dropped out of the sky. There's mm-hmm. a history to it. And the second aspect of it is that Canada has a proud history of being peacemakers. And so it is really very much a stretch and a violation of the Canadian identity as the public perceives it, that, you know, we would be dragged into supporting a military effort, especially if the United Nations does not support it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that I think that reflects Canadian pride, that they are supporters of the United Nations, they are opposed to terrorism, very deliberately, but they operate from the proposition that they're not a superpower and have no desire to be, and consequently, they want to see world cooperation to mm-hmm, solve mm-hmm. problems rather than unilateral action.
And so the media here in the U.S. was criticized heavily by media outside of this country, most recently by the U.N. correspondent, actually, the head of the U.N. press corps, for being extremely gung-ho and overly patriotic with regard to this particular invasion of mm-hmm. Iraq. Did the Canadian media sort of assume a position for or against the war?
I think that they presented a more balanced picture and let you think for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think there's a distortion of patriotism. It is patriotic to be for peace. It is patriotic not to put troops in harm's way. It's patriotic to seek a diplomatic solution. And when we say diplomatic, we mean one that does not involve the loss of life and the destruction of society's cherished base for the living standards. I mean, attacking hospitals and stuff, but I don't need to get into all that.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is the question of the highest patriotic duty is to have one's country cooperating with the rest of the world to achieve the resolution of a problem in a peaceful manner. That's not necessarily a pacifist position. The point is that rather than allow the contagion of war to spread, all of us have to share this planet, and we all have basic desires to be with our families and have a peaceful life.
Mm-hmm.
And when this is amputated by an attitude that I'm going to go it alone and you are either on with me or against me, that, you know, this does not sit well culturally and emotionally with most people of the world. I don't hesitate to generalize mm-hmm. that.
Well, it's interesting. President-elect George Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair's names have been raised as candidates for the Nobel Peace Prize. And we'll see how the world responds to that. But I was amazed that even though there seemed to be worldwide opposition – to the U.S. and Britain going it virtually alone, they were allowed to do so in the face of what seemed like blatant regard for international law and protocol. Your reaction to that?
Well, there was a great upsurge of peace activity, and I'm happy to say that I've lived long enough to see this time when really the world was united, probably not to a great extent, not since VE Day, and this week we're celebrating Victory in Europe Day, you know. There was such a world outpouring to prevent a war. But, you know, countries can unilaterally do, especially if they have the largest arsenal of weapons of mass destruction, a given country and its leadership. And I would say in the United States, a very substantial body of public opinion was opposed to going to war in Iraq or continuing the war in Iraq, especially if it was not in unity with other United Nations partners, I mean, and the UN in Security Council. This was a very grave disruption of the role of the United Nations as a place where people can talk out differences and come to agreement. And it was very tragic to see this institution abandoned, if you will, when it did not go along with certain ideas that the administration had. And I want to say, because we're not only a charter member here in the United States of the United Nations, but the architect of the UN in terms of the idea was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He was commander-in-chief of our country, and I served under him in World War II. And one of his great legacies is the United Nations as an institution that had the capacity to be a forum for people to come together and find remedies.
Have they rendered the UN basically irrelevant at this point?
No, no. I don't think we should ever accept a definition of the United Nations as irrelevant because it was not able to prevent a particular war. There is a body of international law that has been created over the last 50 years of the United Nations. There are about 180 countries. The UN General Assembly was certainly not in favor of this war. That is where the body of the world meets.
But it sort of ended up in the Security Council.
In the Security Council, but then they could not get a majority of the Security Council to do this. So, I mean, why does that make it irrelevant?
Well, because the war took place. The war happened in spite of all this.
Any nation can go to war against any other nation if they choose to ignore the United Nations and go against world public opinion. And that just takes going in another direction.
Mm-hmm.
The question, however, is how does that register in world public opinion and what responsibility does that place on the people of the country that carries out such actions?
Mm-hmm.
What responsibility does that place on us in the case of the United States and Britain? In the name of being part of the world, correct that. You know, that this act of military invasion of Iraq cannot become a pattern if we expect to have any kind of peaceful stability in the world.
Well, it seems as though now the U.S. is setting its sights on Syria, and Iran will be next. And I don't know, perhaps North Korea, these countries that have been identified by the Bush administration as the so-called axis of evil. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, are they unstoppable?
You have heard about this assessment that world public opinion is becoming the second superpower in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's an idea that has to be cultivated and cherished, that world public opinion can be the difference between a world eventually achieving peace and a world being in the grip of a contagion of war in which destruction and destitution would be interminable.
Mm-hmm.
So the world has a stake, and the people of the United States have the primary stake in affirming peace and in cooperating and in community building and in supporting concepts and initiatives that would guarantee that peace champions. It's like Paul Robeson had a song that used to end that peace will conquer war, and we're precisely in that stage. When you have a situation where there is a war mania, then you really have to have a strong commitment to peace so that it overtakes that. Because, you know, we are people of conscience, and when you read about smart bombs knocking out healthcare centers and hospitals, and then you see this tragedy of the great Museum of Antiquities being plundered. Now, there was a good article in one of the Canadian newspapers about the fact that all during World War II, there was a unit of the U.S. Army whose responsibility it was to protect the cultural institutions of Europe as these armies went across Europe. Mm-hmm. That unit still exists, and my understanding from this article that appeared at the Toronto Globe and Mail second or third weekend of April, that this army unit still exists, but it was not permitted to enter Baghdad until 4 days after the plunder had been completed.
Mm. And so when you say, Jack O'Dell, that the world public opinion is a concept, the world public opinion is the second superpower in the world, and that concept is gaining currency, how then does the peace movement here in the United States and I guess the peace movement worldwide translate that opportunity into some sort of action that will further impact the situation that we see unfolding?
Well, the translation has to be into a way of living. It's no one action that's going to do this. We're not looking for the big action.
No silver bullet.
No. And there's no golden ring at the bottom of the ocean. The fact is that it is a way of cooperating, massive communication, every opportunity to build bridges of friendship, cultural exchange. It is initiating a lot of things that enables us to see each other as friends and neighbors and makes it difficult for the process of demonization that always precedes war. You get this demonized concept of an enemy and then all kind of exerted. He's worse than the previous enemy. Mm-hmm. Each war's enemy is worse than the previous enemy. They said that's about Noriega. Mm-hmm. Said he was worse than Hitler. Mm-hmm. Got ready to invade Panama. Well, this is a pattern, and we need to recognize this pattern is not in our interest. And so world public opinion that rests upon the principle that we share this planet together as neighbors. It is easy to become friends. The working people and other people of any nation doesn't have a stake in destroying another nation. That the weapons of mass destruction are just precisely that, and that you could be on a trajectory in the world in which war was a mania, in which we could see the end of the world based upon just an exchange of destruction of destructive capabilities. Mm-hmm. So. Everybody has a stake in making this transition and in coming together to do that. Now, as I said, it is not one action. It's a million actions, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it's a million actions that's based upon peace and respect and mutual appreciation of people and a rejection of chauvinistic ideas, that we are the only important people in the world. Mm-hmm. And there's a terrible, heavy legacy of that in the United States, we saved Europe. So there wasn't no resistance movement. There wasn't no underground mm-hmm. movement in Europe. What we saved, you'd be speaking German. Well, wait a minute now. If we hadn't done this, that, and other thing. Well, the Nazis spoke German, but so did Beethoven and Bach and Schiller, they spoke German too.
Mm-hmm. And you were, did you say that you served in
Yes, I was in World War II. I was in the Merchant Marines.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
and so now you're a pacifist.
Well, I don't think of myself as a pacifist. I think of myself as a human being who lives on the planet with 6 billion other people. And I'm not looking for a fight.
But sometimes a fight does come to a country.
Yes.
Let's say, for example, September 11th.
Yes.
Many Americans feel as though they weren't looking for a fight either, but because September 11th happened, they allowed the Bush administration to convince them that there is a connection between that and Al-Qaeda and possible terrorist attacks, possible future terrorist attacks on this country, and therefore we had to invade Iraq to prevent that.
Well, yes, we're all familiar with that pattern, and I lived in New York a long time. The one city other than Detroit that where I was born that I love in this country is New York. I'm not saying that out of disrespect but for any place. Mm-hmm. I lived in New York 15 years. I shipped out of New York in the Merchant Marines. My children were born in New York. I mean, it's a source of great happiness to me. And I grieved when I saw that city experience terrorist attack. But now, there is no basis for us going mad around that because that's not going to solve any problem. And I support the people that said war is not the answer. And there were people who suffered family loss and friendship loss in that attack that said, well, we must find another way to deal with this because war is not the answer. And it isn't. You know, we're not more secure because we have done this or that war action. You know, this is a very insecure time. It's an insecure time because peaceful solutions are not valued enough to guarantee that they have a chance to be implemented.
Mm-hmm. When you say, Jack O'Dell, that there are probably there need to be many actions to prevent any further aggression on the part of the U.S. and Britain, what might one of those actions be, perhaps, making sure that this Nobel Peace Prize actually goes to individuals who are deserving of it and who are actually peacemakers in the world, and, I don't know, perhaps staging some sort of protest against President Bush and President Blair actually receiving these?
Well, prizes. You know, people are intelligent. We the people of the world, not just of the United States, are intelligent. And people who oppose that will find ways and means of doing this. Jimmy Carter received the Nobel Peace Prize, too, and had a great deal to say about this war mania and so forth. Let us borrow from that. Peace Prize is a symbol of our appreciation for good works that lead to peace. There's no legacy of the Nobel Award giving prizes for going to war.
They could very well start that precedent if they issued
We would be in another state of madness if that was the case. We would have lost a very important symbol of the aspirations of the world for peace if the act of going to war was rewarded with that esteemed prize.
The way that they are casting this action as it's delivering liberation to the people of Iraq, and therefore it's a noble cause. Let me ask you this, Mr. O'Dell. You talked about VE Day and the celebration this weekend. Just refresh our memory, the victory in Europe. There was a whole movement around that.
Yes. Can you just briefly? Well, the end of the war against fascism was marked by an enormous sense of optimism in the people of the world. That people looked forward to the years ahead. The Depression was behind them. The war was behind them. Mm-hmm. And unfinished aspirations were in front of us. Duke Ellington gave a concert in Indianapolis, Indiana that summer. New World A-Comin' was a piece, a jazz. Maybe you're familiar with that piece. It was a jazz a tone poem, he called.
Mm-hmm. New World A-Comin'.
Yeah, reflecting this great hopefulness. Mm-hmm. There was poetry written. There was Shostakovich's Ninth Symphony having to do with the siege of Leningrad. Mm-hmm. You know, expressed this great outpouring of hope. Mm-hmm. The United Nations was formed that summer. We had lost President Roosevelt, but the United Nations met, and Dr. Du Bois was on the committee from the U.S. delegation that mm-hmm. was helping to finish the draft. There was just so much going on that friendship, the international working class movement, the trade union movement, had formed the International Federation of Trade Unions for purposes of United States and the European and the Russian trade unions getting together mm-hmm. to shape the post-war period as a peaceful one in which health care and housing and culture and you know an opportunity would mm-hmm. be open to all. So there was a dream. There was a dream. And the victory over the Depression and World War II had nurtured that dream and its possibility. And we have to return to that optimism. We are not the optimism has gone away because we have seen so many issues. People feel less in command of their lives. But I think that the recent demonstrations represent that reawakening of possibility. Mm-hmm. And if we cling to that optimism, it will be the source of activity that will indeed reinforce the idea that peace is the way. Peace is the way for the world to build friendship and fulfill our dreams.
Finally, Mr. O'Dell, someone who was the chair of the Pacifica Board for over 20 years, a pacifist organization, although you define yourself as a man who, not necessarily a pacifist, but you're not looking for a fight. What is the what's the direction for the peace movement at this time, this moment in history? What is the mission?
Well, I won't be so conceited to think that I have the ideas of what the mission is. I have an idea. I don't have the answer, but I have an idea as a person who's been active around peace. I think that the mission of the peace movement is to accept the challenge that this moment represents, to help to galvanize public opinion around the peace and justice agenda. We can have health care and affordable housing and paid family leave in America. We can have a clean environment, and we can have education for our youth through college. The money we have spent on wars over the last 25 years could have paid for all of that. So I think that the peace movement in our country has a very challenging opportunity to bring enlightenment to a dark moment. But, I mean, that's the dialectic of it. It is a dark moment. But there's also the people who are saying no to war. And an alternative to recognize that peace is really, as has been said many times, more than just the absence of war, it is the presence of justice. Let us put the energy into correcting the injustices and giving people a sense of empowerment at home and abroad, that we do not dislike the people of the world. They're our neighbors, and they are waiting to be neighbors. Mm-hmm. I had the chance to travel in the Merchant Marines, and you are a civilian, you know, in civilian uniform. And generosity and friendship is the common experience. People are not nagging at you, trying to, you know, it's not. So we must not allow the atmosphere of community to be poisoned by this contagion of war. This is a poison we're dealing with, and we have to deal with it clinically. We must get rid of it.
Jack O'Dell, longtime peace activist and former chair of Pacifica Radio's National Board. Now, on a lighter note, we have a skit from the Christmas Coup Comedy Players, produced by Pacifica stations KPFT in Houston and WBAI in New York.
We now take you again live to the Oval Office, where Vice President Dick Cheney and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice are meeting with the President of the United States, George W. Bush.
So,
yeah.
Dick,
yes?
I've decided to take advantage of my ability to make people believe that I know what I'm talking about.
Mm. Excellent idea, Mr. President. Well,
you should cash in big time with that one, Mr. President.
Yeah. I've decided to become a quack.
Oh. Quack.
I will sell my own brand of vitamins, like Gary Knoll, and call myself a healer.
Mm.
Maybe I'll get that Wednesday spot.
Mm.
Others will address me as Dr. President.
Very desirable.
No longer Mr. President.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Dr. President.
Oh, it's a good idea, Dr. President.
Yeah.
My specialty. I have the ability to diagnose a case of treason even before the actual onset of the disease.
That's good.
And my remedy is swift and final, just like it was 87 times or something, maybe 187 times. I think it's a misprint. Maybe 1,087 times during my happy days when I was governor of the Republic of Texas.
Oh, yes.
You know, treason can become contagious.
I got to stop it before it spreads.
In the first wave, rounding up the traitors, we shall detain all voters who have registered something other than the Republican Party.
Oh. We can make the two-party system illegal.
Well, some of those parties may be favorable toward you, Dr. President. The Right to Life Party, the Conservative Party.
They're traitors, Dick.
Only registered Republicans are innocent of treason, Dick.
Yeah. Dick?
Yeah?
I want you to taste this tapioca that was just sent up from the White House.
Oh.
Try it.
Well, I'm not really hungry, Dr. President.
I insist, Dick. Try it.
Well, sounds like an executive order, Dick.
Well, he is the president, Condi.
You got that right, Dick.
Very well. I will taste the tapioca.
Open wide, Dick.
Yeah. Ooh. Mmm. Oh.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Mikey likes it.
Yeah.
Ooh, would you like me to taste the tapioca, Dr. President?
You don't have to, Connie.
Huh?
Tapioca didn't kill Dick. It won't kill you either.
Wait a minute. You mean you're trying to see if the tapioca was poison, Dr. President?
Don't you read the New York Times, Dick?
Well, yeah.
They think somebody poisoned Stalin.
Oh.
Yes. While some suspect Molotov, others think perhaps Malyankov.
I remember my youth when I was flying around Texas drinking Molotov cocktails.
Oh, I love those.
Not all Republicans are innocent of treason, Condi. Not all Republicans. Remember that.
Only you can make the precise diagnosis, Dr. President.
For instance, my brother Jeb, governor of that southern state full of all those old people, thought maybe I saw signs of treason there when the network announced that Al Gore had won my brother's Jeb state.
Jeb's
I'm having a hard time making people understand what I'm saying right now. Let me say it again. All right? Treason down there.
Treason.
People thought in my brother's state that Al Gore had won. That's treasonous.
Well, a good doctor knows even his own brother can be taken ill.
After all, Kane slew
him. Yes.
Is that tapioca affecting you at all, Dick? Or are you this regularly?
No, that's page one in the Bible, Dr. President.
What do you call a professional gambler who plays Texas Hold'em carrying $50,000 in his carry-on bag on a flight to the poorest country in the nation, Tunica, Mississippi, to play in the World Series of Poker?
Well,
let's see, a potential terrorist?
That's right.
Can never be too careful, Condi. As for my brother Jeb being a traitor, it was just sibling rivalry.
Well, Cain and Abel, as I said, Dr. President.
I knew Jeb really loved me. When I found out he had successfully prevented undesirable voters from casting their ballots.
Your brother Jeb turned racial profiling into an art form.
Pretty good diagnostician himself.
Mm-hmm. I want the voters of rich and happy citizens.
Well, the rich are happy to give you their votes, Dr. President.
The rich are happy to be rich, Dick.
Well, yeah.
Let unhappy voters stay home. Let them ask themselves, if I'm not a felon, then why do I have the same last name as a felon?
The Christmas Crew comedy players produced by Pacifica Stations KPFT in Houston and WBAI in New York. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA and Benta Berklin. It's your financial support that makes this program possible. So please pledge your support through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.